Hey everybody, welcome to the Spillers After Show podcast. I'm Brian Dunn.
And I'm Robert Hookman Jr.
And we're here to talk about all things Spillers, and in this case we're talking about Spillers number 5, Robert, which just wrapped at Crescent Ballroom.
Yeah, an hour and a half, 2 hours ago now?
Yeah, about that.
Deep into the night here in the Spillers After Show podcast sessions.
Yes, we've been keeping our guests waiting, unfortunately, and the guest we have right now with us is T.M. McNally,
who we're
going to call Mike. he read a short story. This is like the coolest thing. He wrote a story expressly for tonight for Spillers number 5, and it is entitled Crescent Ballroom, and he is our guest right now. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So tell us there was kind of a special occasion attached to the story that you wrote for this, right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
My eldest son is going off to college, and he's actually going off in 3 days. And the Crescent Ballroom is a really important place for me. And the reason is because when Ted was 14, he came down here. The Crescent Ballroom makes available a space for high school kids to see concerts. And so he came down here and he saw his hero, the tallest man on earth. And so when I was offered, you guys called me up and said, "Would you want to do this?" It seemed a wonderful way to send him off to college.
Yeah, so. I'll say. And he was in the crowd tonight to hear
it. Yeah, he was.
Yeah, how special was that?
It was pretty badass. It was cool.
Has he ever seen you do a reading before?
Yes, once. He was probably 8, 9.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. So it's been a while.
Yeah.
You could say, yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty adorable. He he was 8 or 9, and he, after the reading, he went back to the table and they had some books, and he wrote a sign that said free autographs.
Free autographs.
Free autographs. Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds like something an 8 or 9 year old would do.
And then
you
were stuck to that promise.
Yeah. The more interesting thing is like where the reading took place, I guess. Some places are better to read than others. This was a wonderful place to read. So.
Oh, great.
Good.
Yeah. No,
we absolutely love working with Crescent Ballroom. Like, they're always fantastic. The sound here is great. The venue, everything about this venue is great. So we absolutely love putting writers on that stage.
Yes, we do.
The turnout was amazing.
Yeah, it was 150 plus people tonight.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. No.
It's a good, solid number.
We'll take it.
Tell us about some of these. Okay, so we were talking to Catherine Hill, actually Orly as well.
Orly, yeah.
About how awards come into your life. How does a book go from idea to becoming, like, for example, a New York Times notable book? Like, how does this process happen? Does it start with reviews and work its way up? Like,
well, you know, I don't know. You know, the sausage is made by people far more skilled at making sausage than I am. I really don't know how to reply to that question. I think what we do, all of us who write, is we try and make the thing that seems like the best thing that we can do and be most true to itself and our vision and in ways that communicate with other people. And then you have these very complicated apparati, whatever the word is, that are about things not necessarily about writing.
Okay.
So I don't know why that first novel was on the NYT list. I don't know. I'm grateful for it. It was a wonderful thing. It was cool. I don't know how it happened.
Right.
So I just don't.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice when it does, though, I'm guessing.
I've noticed in some of the stuff that I've read of yours that there's kind of a lot of focus around fathers and sons. That seems to come up a lot.
Yeah.
How autobiographical is that? Yeah. Like, how much, like, what was the what's the thing in your life that comes out in that form in your stories?
I lost my dad twice. I lost him when I was a kid to illness, and then I lost him, I guess it was 12 years ago now, to actual death. So I always thought of myself as having two dads. I had the dad before illness when I was 13, and then there was this other person who was my dad, but who had been severely affected by brain trauma. That has always been a big part of my thing. And then also, you know, I grew up with a religious Episcopal tradition. And so, you know, I'm mindful that, you know, father, son, you know, like you can't think about those things without also thinking about the kind of religious traditions that are invoked with that.
Right. So, right.
I kind of came close to almost going to seminary. So.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And then, I mean, fortunately I didn't. It wouldn't have been right for me. But
yeah.
Still, when I was young, it was a big thing in shaping how I thought about the world.
You mentioned in your story, actually, and I don't know how fictitious it was, but the protagonist was a musician initially, and slight twist of fate, and ended up being a novelist.
Right.
Is there music in your background as well?
Yeah. When I went off to college, I wanted to be Cass Stevens. And that was when it was okay to want to be Cass Stevens. Now there may be issues with that, which I mean, other people know better about those issues than I do. I mean, I grew up, though, on those albums of his, you know, Two for the Tillerman. So, music was a big part of my life. I'd played the guitar since I was 8. And I've always thought that music was probably, like, deeply, really influential in my sense of language and how I approach it, actually.
So is it the same way with your son, then? Is he into music as well?
He is into music. He's a far better guitar player than I am, actually.
Oh.
He's amazing.
Really?
He's,
wow.
He's very good. And So he's going off to college with his guitar the way I went off to college with my guitar. Yeah.
So when you see that, then, as a father, you know, what are your thoughts when you see him, you know, adopting some of the same... same tendencies as you?
Well, he has very literary tendencies, you know. His mom's a poet, and I'm his dad. And
right.
And
it's not a bad hand of DNA.
No, not if you want to make it go with the words. It's not.
But you know, sometimes I kind of feel like I'm like on the flight deck of the aircraft carrier trying to wave off. You know, like. To engage a life committed to the literary arts. Well, in the first place, I think. I would not encourage anybody to commit to a certain particular life path as an undergraduate. I mean, the idea is to be open and expansive to all kinds of possibilities. And I say this as, you know, having spent my professional life as an English professor. So, you know, the most important thing, I think, for a kid is knowing that you're always free to change your mind. Like, I thought I was going to be a rock star. And then I realized, like I didn't have, or not a rock star, but a folk star. Part of it was the timing was bad for me. Folk was on the way out and punk was in. And I had an electric guitar once and I would always get shocked. And I abandoned that. I was an acoustic purist.
Wow.
If you were a true punker, that would have been a badge of honor, getting shocked, by a guitar.
I was also almost electrocuted when I was 8. I went outside to plug in the Christmas tree lights and it was raining. And, you know, I felt those currents going through both arms, and electricity—I don't understand. It's very powerful, and I can't see it. And it kind of spooks me. So I'd never miss the electric guitar thing.
Okay, strictly acoustic for you then.
Yeah, it was. Yeah,
this is almost analogous to how you write, too, isn't it?
Because I suppose, yeah.
We had a kind of a conversation previously about how you. Like I could, so when I read this story, the first thing I thought was, "There's no way a laptop produced this work." I just didn't think it was capable of producing words in that order. I was like, "This feels like it was handwritten."
I did it in longhand. I often work in longhand, and then sometimes I'll move to a screen if I find that I can type faster than I can write in script. So if I'm really becoming flooded, then I'll start typing in order not to be slowed down by the process.
Yeah.
For this thing, I mean, it's short. Mm-hmm. I actually don't really think of it as a piece of fiction. I think of it as a meditative essay. It can be read any way, I guess. But
yeah.
And there are things in there I did change, minor things.
Right. Well, it's a very powerful piece of work, for sure.
Thanks.
No matter how it's read. So, So I'm guessing with the aversion to electricity, no IBM Selectric typewriter then for
well,
you.
Well, you know, my... Oh, God.
We both own Selectrics.
We do. We love IBM Selectrics.
I love them, too.
Do you?
Yeah. I finally gave up. I kept losing repair guys. I just realized, like, John Wayne from... What is that? McClintock? He's up there.
But... Yeah, Mike is gesturing to the photographs on the wall here behind us.
That happens a lot in this room.
Yeah, it's a very confusing decor.
Catherine noted that it has a googly eye attached to him.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Oh, poor guy.
I know.
So my first book is a short story collection, Low Flying Aircraft. Mm-hmm. And I was writing it when I didn't have a lot of resources at hand. So I was teaching at a little prep school in Vermont, and I went to a tag sale and I picked up what I called the one-armed wanker, which was an old-fashioned electric typewriter from like vintage, I don't know, 68 or 74, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was electrical powered, but you still had to hit
the
return
arm. Yeah, right.
And so what would happen is like every time you hit it, it would shift. So it was like 360 degrees. And then, so you get towards the end of the page and you pick it up and then like that.
Oh my gosh. And
it only cost me $10. And it had a.
And that's probably why.
It had a bare electrical cord. So I had to be careful what I touched lest I get.
Oh my gosh.
Zapped.
Yeah. Wow.
And no. That's what my first book was written.
Was it really? Yeah. The whole thing was? You stuck it out to the end with that?
Well, actually, it went from longhand, then it went through, I would type the stories, and then I would try to send them out to people and send them off into the world. And then I got really lucky and fortunate, and certain things happened, and somebody loaned me one of those early Steve Jobs Macs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the little brown
the leases.
Things. Yeah,
the ones that had the handle built in
at
the top.
Yeah, the built-in handle.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then I was able to transfer it to the book to that. But it was still dot matrix printed out. Like,
right.
Who would... I don't know. I don't know who'd read a manuscript that way.
Yuck.
Yeah.
Yeah, seriously. So do you find... How does your writing process work? So if you start, like, longhand... How far do you take that? Have you written entire books longhand? And what's the editing process like when you move from handwritten to typed?
It depends on what I'm working on and how. Like the Goat Bridge, I think most of that book was written in longhand before I transferred it to screen. And then the truth is my eyes are bad now. So when I was able to, like my script... when I was starting out, it was much thinner and narrow. I could put much more on a page. And now I get much fewer words on a page because they have to be so big for me to see them because I'm blind. I'm not really blind, but I'm getting blind. So there's that. It does depend. Sometimes there's a big process where I work in longhand. I might do that in the morning, and in the afternoon I might transfer it into a cleaner version type as a way to look at it again, but I try not to fuss with it. Generally, my working process is I finish the narrative arc of whatever it is before I ever go and mess with editing it. Whether or not that's a 20-page story or a 300-page or a 400 or 500-page manuscript.
Wow.
I don't indulge in rewriting until I'm through the arc. And then I do surgery and stuff like that.
Okay.
And then when I think the book is done, what I do is I print it out, and then I retype the whole thing.
Do you edit along the way then?
As I'm retyping, yeah. I mean, changes are going to be happening.
Yeah, yeah.
And I usually find that puffs up a manuscript like 15 to 20%. So then I have to go back in and comb and cut that out. So
it's that much, 15 to 20%?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For me.
Right, right.
In my experience. So.
Hmm.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. I've actually noticed that myself when I retype anything that I've... I'll start on the Selectric,
yeah,
and then I'll go to the laptop, and when I'm just to make it digital, and in that process of making digital, it just grows as if by magic.
Right.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency to do that at the time.
It's like
sure.
It's drinking a milkshake or something. It just gets a little more.
Yeah, the straw wrapper. You can drop a bead of water in a straw wrapper,
right,
and
it just expands.
Yeah, no kidding. So you run the creative writing program at ASU. How did you end up in that position? Like, where did you come from that led you to that road?
Well, I finished. I did my MFA at ASU, And then I left and I went off and I was gone for about, I think it was 12 years. And then there was a thing that happened and they had a job and blah, blah. So I came back in and that was around, I guess, 16 years ago now. So I came in 16 years ago and I've been teaching there since. And now with various transitions and, you know, the thing that happens is eventually if you stay in a university long enough, you end up doing certain kinds of, I don't know what the word is, administration or things like that.
So right, right.
It's a cool thing.
Sort of like the meetings that you're doing tomorrow. When I asked if you had to teach tomorrow and you said, well, no, not quite teaching. It's going to be meetings tomorrow.
Yeah, I'm doing some meetings. But I also call, though, my individual conferences that I do with my students, I also call those meetings.
Oh, okay.
So it's
all right, that's good.
meeting, and sometimes it's you know, working with a grad student or something like that. Mm. So
yeah, and you find that rewarding, working with the grad students and seeing them.
Oh, of course, yeah.
See them improve over the time. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. We are blessed with our talent that comes through our program. It's and so it's just a thrill and an opportunity, great thing to be of use.
Yeah.
I don't think of myself as a teacher. I think of myself more as a, I don't know. I often call myself Gandalf. you know, I mean, they have to carry the ring. You know, the students, they have to carry the ring. I kind of know like where the various paths are, and so sometimes I can help. And then if the orcs get really bad, then I'll maybe I can blast in. But you know, Frodo, it's like Dorothy. You know, they're gonna do the work, and they're gonna do it, and they know how to do it. So
right.
I think teachers, I try to work with a light touch. Is what I'm saying.
Do you? Yeah. Well, we can certainly attest to the level of talent that. Goes through the program. I mean, we've had just so many great spillers.
You know, well, just, you know, I've done some numbers recently, and we have, what is it? It's there's 177 books in the Hayden Library from graduates of our program. And there's another 77 on order. And we have 10 books being published by graduates this year.
Wow.
It's an amazing thing with many moving pieces and many different commitments from all parts of the university towards it. It's pretty cool.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of talent coming out of that program. We've put a good number of them on stage, and I'm sure we'll be putting a lot more of them on stage.
I'm sure we will, yeah.
Wow, that's fantastic. So all I can say is, like, just endlessly thank you for doing us the honor of writing this piece just for the occasion. I realize it was a special occasion for you, but the fact that you wrote a piece just for this makes it a special occasion for us as well.
Well, you guys gave me the opportunity to do this, and I'll tell you this, you can cut this if you want. So like the Crescent Ballroom, that's pretty loaded language for me. The Crescent, if you look at the glyph on the astrological sign for Taurus, you have the sun with the horns, but the horns are often called the crescent moon. Mm-hmm. And so that crescent moon is what connects the earth with the spiritual heavens. That's one way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. So then you have Baal, you know, the mother of my children's last name is Baal.
Yeah.
And then you have room, space to grow. So just this, you know, do you want to write something for the Crescent Ballroom? And yes, I do. And I'm really grateful for that opportunity. To do this, it was a wonderful thing for me.
Yeah,
so thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it was wonderful for us to witness you reading up there and for you to share your story.
So, yeah, and that story definitely got quite a response.
Oh my gosh, it got a great response. Yeah.
So when I introduced you, I talked about like the first story of yours that I read in the Gateway, and I was like, I just sat in my living room for 5 minutes and had goosebumps on my arms, and. I honestly texted Brian right afterwards, and I said, wow, compared to Mike McNally, we're all children playing with sticks.
Playing with sticks is what he said.
And I felt like that again when you sent the Crescent Ballroom to me, and I read it, and I was like, wow, I again sat there for 5 minutes with the chills and sent it to Brian, and Brian wrote back, and he only had three words, and they went like this, that story, man.
Yeah.
And I knew what that meant because I know Brian. And Brian is an incredibly discerning reader. And I think he holds us both to a higher bar than I probably would on my own.
Nice of you to say.
And so when he gets floored by a story, like, you know, there's there's something serious to it. And I honestly, like, when I got to do my light copy edit dusting of it, I was like, I feel like I'm holding glass right now. I'm just trying not to leave my fingerprints on this story. Mm. And just, you know, question the things that need to be questioned, but leave it as intact as possible, because this is a voice that needs to shine. And
well, you have a good editorial hand.
Thank you.
Nice. Wow. Yeah.
Thank you.
I've worked with a couple. That's good.
I bet. One more quick question for you. Yeah. What was it like to interview John Updike?
Oh my God, I was terrified.
I bet it was terrifying. Oh, you were like, God. What, 17, 18
I
at
was,
the time?
I was nine. I had just... like, Updike. And all my professors would, Updike. And so I wanted to please my professors, and my professors, and so I thought, well, I need to bring myself up to speed on John Updike. And so I was reading Roger's version. And so I don't know if you know Roger's version. It's part of the trilogy, of the Hawthorne trilogy books of his. And it's from the point of view of a contemporary Roger Chillingworth. And mm-hmm. he's like a really cranky academic. And so I'm reading it, and there's all these descriptions about how the narrator just can't stand these graduate students with their brown, soft shoes. And so when I went to interview John Updike with my friend Dean Stover, I was wearing brown, soft shoes. And he was in a suit, this beautiful, meticulous suit.
Wow.
And I was convinced, like, I was so, oh, my God. And the thing about Updike,
yeah,
he was so kind. He was so generous. He knew we were just like completely terrified of like not doing this right or correct or whatever it was.
Sure.
And it taught me like this most incredible lesson for me, when I've always carried it with me, which is when you're strong, you can be nice. And actually, when you're not strong, you can be nice too, and it helps one become strong. But the larger point is like, he was so kind and so generous, as opposed to this kind of daunting image that I had been projecting onto him. It was it was a big change or something for me.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it was cool.
that was cool.
And then we worked on the interview with him, and he edited it for us. And
oh, he did.
You know, we had like a lot of tape. Okay. And then we sent it to him. We transcribed it, and then we sent it to him. And then he went over it, and then he sent it back to us. And very kind and generous. I'm sure the transformative experience it was for me and my friend was far more than, I mean, it was a lot of labor for him. And, you know, yeah. John Updike did not need to do an interview for our literary magazine. I was very young.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
How cool. Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah.
Just being edited by John Updike. Wow, that would be...
It was a little meta, because he was editing himself after we were...
editing
I don't know
work.
What it was.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. Well,
all right.
Well, Mike, we really want to thank you for taking part in Spillers number 5. The story was just fantastic. And
thanks.
Thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast as well.
All right. Rock and roll. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.